From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We hear all the time now about anger, that we live in an age of anger, that anger is driving our politics, our public life. Maybe it's your anger. Philosopher Martha Nussbaum has thought a lot about anger, what it's good for, what it's not, when to let it rip, when to let it go. She's thinking about forgiveness, too. This hour On Point, Martha Nussbaum on anger and forgiveness. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Does anger look like a useful tool to you right now, like an overused tool? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear from writer J.D. Vance about the collapse of church communities and morale, he says, in poor white America. But first, anger. It is easy to hear it. It's just about everywhere in the news. Here was Donald Trump, just one example, on CNN in January.
I am angry. I'm angry, and a lot of other people are angry, too, at how incompetently our country is being run. I'm extremely angry and upset about it. I think it's ridiculous.
Angry, angry, angry. How many times can you say angry in one or two sentences? Joining me now from Chicago is the philosopher Martha Nussbaum. She teaches law and ethics at the University of Chicago, author of many books on human emotion and motivation, including The Fragility of Goodness, Sex and Social Justice, From Disgust to Humanity. Maria Popova, Brain Pickings, the popular online philosophy digest, calls her one of the most remarkable and luminous minds of our time. Her latest book is titled Anger and Forgiveness, Resentment, Generosity, Justice. Martha Nussbaum, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's very good to be back.
Did you ingeniously plan this book to be coming out in the middle of the 2016 campaign, or is this a lifelong interest of yours?
Well, you know, it is. I mean, the emotions in general are a lifelong interest, and I've written about many other emotions, and I hadn't written about anger. So about 4 years ago, when I had a big series of lectures to give, I chose anger for the topic, but I had no idea that this would be so central to our political landscape when the book came out.
You take us all the way back to ancient Greece, and I really want to go there and look at some very early, deep human thinking about anger and its dynamics. But bring it right up to date right now. I mean, do you have a sense that everybody talks about this moment of anger or age of anger that we're in? Do you agree? Does it feel like anger is, the amplitude of anger is higher now than it's been in your memory?
Yeah, it does feel that way. And it brings out one particular thing that I focus on in the book, and that is that when people feel helpless and they don't know what to do going into the future, it's very easy for them to latch on to anger because it gives the illusion of control. So they think if I can just whap somebody and pay them back, then that's doing some good.
You're a philosopher.
And I think people are feeling helpless right now.
Well, and one can understand why. I mean, we're not here to say that anger is inappropriate. You've got all kinds of politicians talking about things that are off the rails and, you know, when things aren't right. And I want to look at this with you. You say there are times when anger is quite useful, but you're a big philosopher. So take us all the way back to fundamentals here. What is anger?
Okay. So what is anger? So there's a surprising agreement, not only in the history of Western philosophy, but also in Indian philosophy. I don't know about other world traditions so much, that anger is a painful emotion that contains the idea that you or someone or something you care about has been seriously damaged by a wrongful act, that is something that the person had no right to inflict on you. And then, and here's the clincher, the additional thought that it would be a very good thing that that perpetrator would suffer for what he or she has done. So it's that part that I think is a false lure that gives us an illusion that retributive payback would actually make things better. But there's no reason to think that. It's just a kind of mystical thinking that the idea of balancing pain for pain would actually be helpful.
You've got justice right in the title of this book. You go there instead. If you feel anger, what, be more forward looking, not backward looking. Look to create a more just circumstance.
Right. So I think if you keep the first bit of anger, that is a wrongful act has happened, it's wrong that that should have happened, and then you turn to the future and you say, okay, what shall we do about that? Because turning back to the idea of paying back pain for pain is not so useful. So if you turn to the future, and I talk about some great historical examples like Martin Luther King Jr., who always refused the lure of payback and hatred, but instead asked, well, what should we do? How can we get together to work? And what can we hope for? What can we make happen? That's the thing that I favor. And I think all the great revolutionaries of the 20th century, Gandhi, King, Nelson Mandela, have been people who rejected anger with the idea of payback, but said that when great wrongs have occurred, we have to turn to the future and make something good happen.
When you look around right now and hear the anger, whether it's anger in the UK that led to the Brexit vote, perhaps, or anger at a Trump rally, or anger at a Sanders rally. Bernie Sanders talks about anger as well over injustice. Do you see it pitched toward solutions and justice in the future, or do you hear it pitched toward payback, retribution?
I hear it pitched towards payback. And I think the Brexit is the clearest example where they had not given 2 seconds of thought to what they're actually going to do going forward. It was all about payback. It was all about paying back these immigrants who are taking our jobs, paying back the EU for inflicting all these alleged costs. And you can see right now they're just floundering because they haven't got the slightest creative idea about what to do next.
I mean, maybe you're right, but what if you're one of the people on the short end of the stick of globalization, whether in the U.S. or the U.K., and you feel that elites don't give a hoot and it just hasn't been well managed and it's hurting you and your family? Is anger about that, about payback, or is it trying to fight toward a better future?
Well, I think that it's often very, very mixed in movements like the Sanders movement. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of people who have creative solutions in mind, but there are plenty of other people who just want to smash the system. I grew up in the early 70s, you know, where there were some revolutionaries who really had an idea about how to fix the U.S. and make it more egalitarian, but there were lots of other people who just wanted to smash the military-industrial complex. And I think the Sanders movement has that same mixture. So look, the problems created by globalization are very complicated. They require very subtle economic and political thinking. We have to think about whether free trade has had its day, or whether we should go over to some form of protectionism, something that I personally do not favor. But anyway, we have to debate these things in a very serious way instead of just thinking, I'll pay back the bankers. And that's the kind of rhetoric that I deeply mistrust.
Anger is something very deeply seated in human nature. You go all the way back to the ancient Greeks and talk about Aeschylus and the rest, and how in his dramas he looked at how to handle this. He talked about the Furies, the sort of mythological embodiment of anger, and the deal that Athens made in the work of Aeschylus to what move anger from something absolutely wild and bloodthirsty, transition into something more useful in a civic sense. Take us back through that, Martha.
Okay, so the Greeks were obsessed with this problem. The very first word in Homer's Iliad is anger, and it's an anger that brought thousandfold destruction on the Achaeans. So what Aeschylus is doing is to create a drama that shows the rule of law emerging out of the hopeless search for payback that went generation after generation. So instead of having everyone burdened by retributive anger year after year and generation
vendettas.
After generation,
mm-hmm.
vendettas, you know, somebody kills your father, so then you kill them, and then they try to kill your children, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we get law, and law takes over the task of dealing with crime, but notice that it's not the same problem. The problem itself now is changed to one from payback to let's try to figure out how to make a flourishing society in the future. So the Furies don't just yield to the rule of law, but they have to change their nature. They have to become the kindly ones, they have to listen to rational persuasion, and they have to seek the welfare of the entire city. The Greeks and Romans did not favor retribution in the theory of punishment. They thought that punishment often was good as a deterrent or as a kind of incapacitation, but the idea of paying back was what they were really trying to reject.
The Furies, of course, were visualized as these horrible black dogs vomiting blood. I mean, it's absolutely bloodthirsty.
Yeah.
So that there was that keen awareness that there's something in us that wants that, that goes for that. And he was trying to convey a transformation, but really from bloodthirsty to the kindly ones?
Well, you know, I think anger is probably evolutionarily hardwired, and that at some prehistoric stage, it might have been very useful to have that payback reflex. But what the Greeks and Romans already thought is it's very immature, and we have to go beyond that. Actually, they did not think that anger was manly. They thought it was childish, and they even said womanish, because they thought women were weak creatures. And so they wanted to figure out a way of going beyond that by thinking more constructively about social welfare and about how to make a good society. And so in the Iliad, you get the last book where Achilles finally lets go of his anger and makes a deal with the enemy in order to return the corpse and to get to end the war. So that's one example. But of course, it goes all the way through that history.
We've got just half a minute before the break. You talk about forgiveness also, but you do not just flip from you don't just say no to anger and yes to forgiveness. It's more subtle than that.
Yeah, you know, I think in a lot of traditions, forgiveness is a concealed form of anger. It says, all right, I'll give up my angry feelings if you will confess, if you will grovel, if you will promise not to do it again. We see this a lot in divorce and personal hostility. And so that kind of forgiveness, which I call transactional forgiveness, seems to me problematic because it really doesn't let go of the anger. It just gives it a new form. I'm in favor of a kind of forward-looking generosity that says, okay, let's figure out how to start again and make things better. That might not be in a relationship with that person, of course.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We are talking in our great moment of public anger, political anger, with philosopher Martha Nussbaum about anger and forgiveness, how they work, how humans have dealt with them for millennia, how we might deal with them now, wield them now. Her new book is Anger and Forgiveness. You can join us this hour. How do you think about anger? Are you repulsed by it? Are you full of it? When is it useful? When is it destructive? And what about forgiveness? When is it essential? When is it ducking the issue, or just transmuting anger maybe into another form? And of course, yes, there's Donald Trump, but Bernie Sanders has been out there with plenty of talk about anger as well. Martha Nussbaum joins us from Chicago. She's a professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. Martha, a lot of callers for you. Angel in Miami, Florida is calling. Angel, you're on the air with Martha Nussbaum. Thanks for calling.
People that have gotten family, you know, killed in these terrorist acts. And, of course, some of them are expressing anger. How would you deal with that if it was one of your family members?
I think, of course, it's a wonderful question. I actually think that the gay community is giving a marvelous example of a creative response.
After Orlando.
Which is to get up to Orlando, and that's to say, look, we stand for love. That's who we are. That's what we stand for. And we believe that love is more powerful than hate. That's very much what Martin Luther King Jr. did. And therefore, it's not surprising that in the Charleston shooting, the racist shooting by Dylann Roof, the people in that church also said, well, you know, we're not perfect. We still feel some anger, but we want to get beyond that. We want to create a new future based on love. And so I think that's the thing to do. Of course, doesn't mean that we don't try, convict, and punish the offender, but we don't focus on payback. We try to figure out what to do next to create a better world.
I mean, there's some payback in there. People go to jail. Jail is not about the future. It's about
the past.
Well,
jail isn't necessarily... No, it is about the future, in my view. In my view, you think first about... You think about three things, or four things. You think about what's called incapacitation, that is keeping the bad person from harming other people.
Okay.
You think about specific deterrence, that is making that person less likely to do that in future. You think about general deterrence, that is sending a message to society that we don't tolerate this sort of thing. And finally, you might think about reform, because at least with juvenile offenders, there is that chance that they can be changed by some kind of experience, but then, of course, not the hideous and disgusting experience of a United States prison.
I guess our prison system has made me think less about reform lately. Elizabeth, in Charleston, South Carolina, you're on with Martha Nussbaum. Thanks for calling, Elizabeth.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I wanted to say that I do live in Charleston, and I also experienced murder of my 17-year-old son by strangers, people that he had no association with. It was just a random act of violence, and we did go through the court process, and there was a sentencing. And, of course, you want to feel anger as a human being, but I use my faith as a guide, and I'm a Christian. And God says, vengeance is mine. And so that's where I try to leave the true, you know, punishment or judgment or whatever is not going to be in the court system in my eyes. But we did get a conviction. So I'm thankful for that. And just trying to use my anger to, trying to think of ways I can channel my passion for justice and a righteous anger to be more supportive of the police, who were very helpful to our family, and the solicitor, who did a great job, and the detectives who solved the case, and those types of things. And I'm also a preschool teacher, and I'm learning about this program called Conscious Discipline that helps children to understand their emotions of anger and what is actually happening in their brain while they're angry, and how to sort of calm down before they are ready to speak and communicate about what is happening with them.
Elizabeth, you've had to walk a long road in this realm. I'm sorry for your son.
Yeah, first of all, I'm really, really sorry to hear the pain that you've experienced, but I want to really applaud what you're doing, because I think, in my book, I have this concept that I call the transition, where you take your anger and you turn from that obsession with payback to the future, and you do something productive, and you get involved in some general cause. And I think that's exactly what you are doing, and I think it's great.
What about, Elizabeth, thank you for your call, and hang in there. What about when that cause is a political campaign that may itself be heavily tinged with anger, whether it's Trump or Sanders, you name it? It's a transition, but it may be like a gathering of angers, of many angers. Maybe it's justified. Maybe it's needed.
But justified, not fully. I mean, I think the desire to pay back with the thought that that's going to actually counterbalance or make good the offense, that's always a false scent. And so it's never to that extent fully justified. I do think that the movements I talk about, Gandhi, King, and Mandela, mm-hmm. all had a very strong leader who really sent a powerful message of non-anger. King wouldn't even let people go on protest marches until they had engaged in what he called self-purification, where they meditated and got rid of their anger. Mandela says it took him those 27 years in prison to let go of his own desire for payback. So it's really hard. And in a democratic political campaign, you just can't say to people, don't go to the Sanders campaign until mm-hmm. you've engaged in self-purification. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you got to put up with a set of mixed motives that are sometimes hard to sort out. But I guess you can only take responsibility for your own motives and for the general kind of rhetoric that you use and that you support.
But the Greeks understood, as do people today, that some element of anger can be a potent kind of a combustible chemical for change.
Well, I think that anger can be instrumentally useful up to a point, because it can motivate you to get into a movement that addresses real problems. And King even said this. But he said, once you get there, you better quickly change from that payback obsession to a focus on the future, because you got to work with the people that are on the other side if anything is going to be achieved. And so to demonize them, to want to pay them back, is not very helpful. So it's fine to get there through anger, but you better be prepared to change.
John in Smyrna, Georgia. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. It's a great topic. I want to make the point that in this country, we really or turn ourselves into a nation of fortunate victims. You know, I've worked overseas in Africa, South America, and, you know, just what we have here is so, even with our problems, it is so much better to come here and, you know, not have, like, 12 lanes of traffic that are free, or even if they are jammed up, at least, you know, you're not always fighting for your life. You have generally clean water, generally clean air. You know, you can go to the grocery store to get food. We're just, you know, we're turning into making this, we're not really using our anger correctly, as your guest is making the very good point. We're letting it be unfettered and untamed. If we use our anger, like she says, for the positive and to, you know, use that energy to make something better, then we have a right to say we're angry, but not 100% of the time.
Unfettered and untamed. John, let me hold that right there, that characterization, and get one more call if I may. Mike in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Thank you, John. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to make the point that we are what we eat. If we look at our media consumption, media betrays so much anger that we are just distilling it and throwing it straight back. Hyperbole seems to be a very big problem with a lot of media portrayal, and it's just leading us to further and further intensify our language so that we always appear angry.
Oh, I couldn't agree more with you. I think it's very distressing that the media are hooked on these episodes of anger and the desire for payback. And there's so much constructive work for the good. And people say to me when I'm being interviewed from abroad, oh, in America, there's nothing but anger. And I say, no, you know, if you go onto the south side of Chicago, you see people from churches meeting with the police, and you see people searching very hard for a constructive solution. But of course, that doesn't get into the media. It's not dramatic. And yeah, I agree totally that we need to think about how to portray the constructive and good work that's going on in American society.
What does philosophy tell us about perhaps we have a culture of anger now? Our caller John says, unfettered, untamed, just we let it rip so easily.
Yeah, I think it's part of the American ideal of masculinity, frankly. It was not the same in Greece and Rome. So Cicero writes to his brother, who's a governor someplace in the middle, what's now the Middle East, and he says, Quintus, you're doing pretty well, but I hear that you get angry often, and I want to tell you, that's really childish, and in fact, it's womanish. So, you know, that's the kind of thing they said, but we say something different. You are a real man if you let it rip. And I think we only half believe that. I think we love heroes like the Gary Cooper of High Noon, who's not quite a pacifist, but he only uses violence in defense of the community. He's not really a man of anger. We love heroes like Atticus Finch, who's a man of sympathy and commitment. So, you know, America's divided, but at least one part of it is this idea that a real man will really pay back any injury.
Carter in Nahant, Massachusetts. Carter, you're on.
Yes. I look at anger as we get involved. We react to other people's anger, and we become part of it. Therefore, we amplify it. And one of the ways to escape that is when someone gets angry at you is to understand that it's not about you that they're raising their anger. It's about them. And to let them have their own anger and not respond to it. Therefore, you can walk away and not become part of it. I also feel that forgiveness is something that we remove our reaction to somebody else. That's how we forgive. It's like saying, okay, I'm no longer going to let you control my life by my reaction to you. I'm going to let go of it and then get control back of my life.
Carter, we hear the seaside of Nahant right there, and I love it. Martha, what about it? The walk away instead of amplifying, and forgiveness as a kind of taking control.
I think that's basically great. I would just add that walking away, if that means just not facing the real problem, might not be enough. So what I would prefer to say is you don't demonize the person, but you do address the problems created by the wrongful act. And you try to think, how shall I prevent wrongful acts in the future? And in the case of crime in American cities, it's got to be a multifactored solution. solution, including education, employment opportunities, nutrition, family, work with families, and so on. So just to throw a lot of people in jail is a way of not facing the problem. But to walk away is also another way of not facing it.
You quote Aristotle talking about how anger is often a response to a kind of downranking, of losing status in society. That seems to be a big issue right now in our country. Our caller John says, well, you've got it better than many other countries, but a lot of people feel that they've just lost their standing, their status. How does that factor in?
Well, white American men are doing much worse than they did in previous generations, and it's reflected in their health. We now know that longevity is declining, that prescription drug addiction is going way up, and so on. So there's a real problem, and it's not just a problem of status because it involves health and it involves employment, but it's easy to perceive it as just being dissed by American society. And I think when you see it in those terms, you're very likely not to solve the real problem because you think, oh, if I can just put these other people in their place, then automatically by pushing them down, I raise myself up. But that's not really focusing on the real problem, which is, for example, that manufacturing and construction jobs have moved overseas, that there's not enough education to get other kinds of jobs that would be available. And so facing the real problem is what you need to do.
Talk about forgiveness then. You take it back the way many think about it to Judeo-Christian thinking. And yet you've already told us you see it as a kind of, in some odd way, in your view, as an extension of anger. Do you see a... What do you mean exactly by that? And are you saying we need something other than forgiveness or a particular kind of forgiveness you recommend?
Well, there in the Christian Gospels, there are really three different things. One is a kind of conditional forgiveness. That is, you'll be forgiven on condition that you do this and this and this, which often involves confessing, abasing yourself, and so on. Mm-hmm. Now, that might or might not be okay when you're dealing with God. I don't comment on that. As one caller said, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I don't believe in that kind of God, but many people do. But, you know, the problem, transferring it to the human realm, is that that really is a kind of a displaced anger. You say, only if you do this humiliating performance will I be willing to waive my angry feelings. Now then, also in the Gospels is an unconditional kind of forgiveness that says we should just give up our anger against our enemies.
Which we've heard again and again out of Charleston, out of Orlando.
Right. And then the third thing is like not even focusing on the giving up of anger, but just saying unconditional love. And that's what I see in the parable of the prodigal son. The father sees the son coming from a long distance, and he doesn't know whether the son is going to apologize or not. He has no idea whether the son is even aware that he's committed some wrongful act. He just loves him, and he wants to receive him with love, and then no doubt he'll give him advice about the future, and he'll try to tell him how to lead a better life and so on. But the first step is unconditional love. And that is what Nelson Mandela really understood, that you don't move a country forward if you say, no, wait a minute, I'll talk to you only if you prove to me that you're not a racist. He just received people in a generous way and then, of course, tried to put legal institutions in place that would guarantee a non-racist society in the future.
Do you see an emerging understanding here that might help us use all the anger out there right now in a more effective way? Or do you see anger still just mounting and kind of, what did our callers say, unfettered and untamed in the U.S. right now, Martha?
Well, you know, we have to wait and see what happens, I guess I want to say. I think that the British thing is very interesting because the anger mounted and mounted, unfettered and untamed. But now people are totally flummoxed because they see that it's not doing any good. So it's like, I feel like it's a demonstration of my argument, and we'll see where people go next.
Let us not land in exactly that same spot if that's the way they're feeling.
Right.
Martha Nussbaum is philosopher, professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. Her new book is Anger and Forgiveness, Resentment, Generosity, Justice. Martha, thank you so much for being with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom, and to all the callers, too.
We come back, we'll talk with J.D. Vance. He's looking at poor white Americans and sees a culture in crisis. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In his new memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance writes about a culture in crisis, poor, white Americans. It's about his childhood spent in the coal country of Appalachia and his years spent in the Marines and at Yale Law School, but it's also an anguished look at working class dysfunction, poverty, joblessness, poor education, opioid addiction, erosion of family ties, erosion of church ties that have led to what he describes as hillbilly culture to abandon, he says, the American dream. J.D. Vance joins me now in the studio. You can join us on air or online. Do we have a poor white culture in crisis today? The new book by J.D. Vance is Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. J.D. Vance, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hillbilly is a word that we use very, very rarely and cautiously here. You can sort of downgrade a whole lot of people with that. Who are you calling hillbilly and why?
Well, I think I'm calling hillbilly the broader class of white working class folks who come from Appalachia. So pretty big region stretches from, you know, Alabama up through parts of New England. It is certainly a word I think that has a lot of political overtones and controversy. And, you know, it's funny. My grandma once told me that we're allowed to call ourselves hillbillies, but nobody else can say it because then, you know, then I'll do something to them and I won't say that on air. But
where'd you grow up? Did your grandma call your own family hillbillies?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Hillbillies is kind of a term of pride if it's used internally. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up mostly in the Rust Belt town of Middletown, Ohio. And, you know, but I spent a lot of time in Eastern Kentucky because I grew up with my grandparents for
your family, you know, had come from that region.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that was, we were really, I think, in some ways, cultural immigrants to what was a middle class oasis of southwestern Ohio. But by the time I came of age, it was really suffering from the same problems that Eastern Kentucky did.
What's the crisis that you're describing in your memoir? I mean, you root it in your own family's story, but you're making a larger point than your own family's story.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the crisis is in some ways a crisis of faith, a crisis of faith in God. You know, statistics show that we've abandoned the church and abandoned regular church attendance, and I think that has negative consequences. It's a crisis of faith in the American dream. We used to really believe in this country. I think it's one of the things that gave great meaning to my childhood. But frankly, I think we've lost faith in that too. And I think a lot of the other institutions that are a big part of our lives have really not seemed to work out for us. And I think people are sad and people are upset about it.
What's driving that? Do you take it back to, we've heard a lot about globalization in recent days, about the export of manufacturing, about, of course, now, talk about Eastern Kentucky, we're cutting back in many ways on coal mining because of the fossil fuel consequences of that. If there's despair, what's driving it?
So I think that's a really complicated question. I think the despair is obviously driven by a lot of economic factors, factories closing down, coal mines closing down, and certainly that feeds into the despair that people feel and causes them to behave in certain ways, obviously some ways that aren't especially productive. On the other hand, I also think that some of the despair comes from the choices we make and the way that we treat our kids. As I talk about in the book, a lot of the problems that I faced as an adult stem from the fact that, you know, we moved around a lot. We saw a lot of domestic abuse in the home, and we were constantly exposed to what I call a revolving door of father figures. And I think because of that, we actually, in some ways, never really figured out how to be successful adults in a modern information economy. So all this stuff fits together, and I think it's complicated, but I think that looking internally would help a lot, and I think, you know, some better economic indicators would help too.
You ended up at Yale Law School, so something worked all right there. But you also describe in great detail in the book how rough things were as a kid sometimes. Do you think things are materially much worse now? You describe a kind of a post-war sort of a hillbilly, as using your word, outbound hope. You know, we were going to get out of that trap. We're going to get into the American economy. We're going to make it. Do you see things really worse now?
I do see things worse in a lot of ways. And Yale was in some ways such an unbelievable culture shock for me, because I felt for the first time in my life out of place. I felt like I didn't belong. I didn't talk the right way. I didn't think the right way. And I didn't act the right way.
Quote unquote right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so I think because of that, folks like me are always going to feel really uncomfortable in places where the elites occupy. And so long as we feel uncomfortable, and I think in some ways we're feeling more and more uncomfortable as time goes by, I think that we're in a tough spot, and it's going to be hard for us to make it in this very new American economy.
You say lots of the population that you're writing about here, and it's a population that you and your own family come out of, if you call and ask them, you poll them, they'll say, yes, I'm Christian. But that church attendance is down markedly and that has big consequences. Take us in there.
Yeah, and I think this is something that a lot of folks from my new culture, what, you know, folks back home pejoratively call the elites, don't really appreciate about church. You know, they see church as all about doctrine and faith and what people believe. But where I live now, people have all these trappings of community that are really important. They have community groups. They have their jobs. They have intact friend and family groups.
You're in California now.
Exactly. I'm in San Francisco now. Mm-hmm. And so they don't realize that back home, folks don't really have a lot of those same benefits of culture and community. And what the church does, I think, both in my own life and statistically, you see it very clear in a lot of economic studies, is church gives people a sense of community, a sense of how they should behave, social support when mm-hmm. times are tough. And in a world where white working class folks are going to church less and less, which they are, they're losing that. And they're losing that in this time where they really need that social support, I think, more than they've needed it before.
What's the evidence of that? I mean, maybe people just haven't caught up, but there seemed to be such an evangelical resurgence in recent decades. But you've written recently, the white church has seemingly disappeared. Really?
Yeah, I think that really is true. Now, the white church hasn't disappeared among all white people. Where it's really disappeared is among the working class. If you look at lower income folks, they're really not attending church as frequently as they used to. That shows up both in how they report their own church attendance. That shows up both in how the church reports folks coming in. And obviously, it's something that I saw a lot in my own life. You know, people really deeply believe in the Christian faith back home. The problem is they're not really going to church that much. So they may think of themselves as Christian, but they're losing out on a lot of the benefits that come with their faith.
You wrote recently in an essay in the New York Times, a Christianity constant. There's also politicization at the same time. So deinstitutionalization, not going, and politics coming here. And you write, a Christianity constantly looking for political answers to moral and spiritual problems gives believers an excuse to blame other people when they should be looking in the mirror. I mean, this population is up against some pretty tough challenges, but you write, paranoia has replaced piety.
Absolutely, and I don't want to understate the challenges. I think there are a lot of external factors that are making it really hard for our people. The way that I think about it is that, you know, you can make lemons, you can make lemonade with lemons, or you can make something a lot worse, and we've made something a lot worse. And the point that I would make is that what we can do, what we can control, is to think about how we treat our children, to think about how we build our families, to think about how we build successful churches and community institutions. It doesn't mean it's going to solve all of our problems. It doesn't mean we can control the macroeconomy, but I think that we can make things a little bit better. And frankly, for kids like me, a little bit better can mean all the difference.
Donald Trump has done, by some lights, surprisingly well among evangelical Christian communities, but you write that he's fared best among evangelicals who rarely attend church.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you think about what a Trump rally gives folks, it gives people fiery sermons, it gives people a sense of community, and it gives people an opportunity to really, I think, emotionally connect to something that's going on in their lives. Frankly, in some ways, it's really similar to a modern evangelical megachurch sermon. And it's unsurprising that the folks who don't...
Except it doesn't have a whole lot of, almost no Christian teaching in it.
Has almost no Christian teaching in it, but it has a lot of the other trappings of church. And so when you think about Donald Trump and you think about the success that he's had among primarily non-church-going evangelicals, I don't think it's entirely surprising. The flip side of it is that, you know, among non-church-going evangelicals, these are also the folks who are struggling the hardest, I think, are the angriest about their lives and about the world they see around them. And obviously, Trump has tapped into that anger in a way that surprised a lot of people.
J.D. Vance is writing about his own family and the wider culture in his new memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. J.D., we have callers for you from Stillwater, Oklahoma. Ricardo is calling. Ricardo, you're on the air with J.D. Vance.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I was wanting to focus more on value. Do you think that we've lost value in the quality of life, and that has isolated us from our local society. You know, you don't want to tell people your problems, you're struggling, you're working hard to purchase items in your life that don't last as long as it used to in the 50s and the 60s. And we've lost, in an effort to go towards efficiency, we've lost value in general, and we feel isolated. Is that something that you see?
I absolutely think that that's right, and thanks for the call. You know, I write in the book that my aunt actually had a black eye from her own father. It wasn't an intentional hit, but it came as part of a family fight. Mm-hmm. And she wouldn't even tell her older brother who had moved out of the house. She was too afraid to talk to an outsider. So I think the isolation you talk about is absolutely something that's a part of our community. And frankly, it makes things a lot worse if you don't talk about these problems. If you can't find support from other people when you're going through these problems, then it's just going to make things worse. And I do worry about what you talk about.
I'm talking about a culture in crisis among poor white Americans with J.D. Vance. Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you for calling, Peter. You're on.
Hello, Tom. You know, this is the poverty in the white has been going on for a long time since Jamestown and Plymouth Rock and all of that, because when the English sent people over, they sent over their white refuse, or so they regarded it, and with their individualism and Calvinism, they figured, oh, well, maybe they'll pull themselves up by their bootstraps in the new land, and maybe they'll be worth something. And the chap here and people in Appalachia are they're descendants of all of this, and in American history, poor white people, I mean, you have slavery, one thing, but you had white slaves, often people indentured in a certain way, and these people have been made to feel so frigging downtrodden all these long, long years. One forgets they have families, they have love, they have feelings too, and of course with Donald Trump, who in my view is a fascist anyway. But it's awfully easy to get hooked into Mr. Trump's xenophobic message because it makes them feel like, gee, there is somebody who's got a grip about who I am and that I belong to.
Peter, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. I mean, I don't know about you, J.D. My folks, my first American ancestor came as an indentured servant. Yes, it was a very common. Of course, he wasn't in chains. He wasn't a slave. He wasn't the subject of genocide on this continent, but... you know, he was poor as can be, and yet here you are, you're doing all right. I'm at this microphone right now, but you look out across and you see a lot of despair. Peter says it's gone on since the beginning. You see it as somehow worse or on a downward slide right now, rather than an ascent that we all hoped or imagined would be the sort of ultimate path here. You know, you got people on opioids and meth and the works right now. Is it as simple as globalization, keeping that persistent economic pressure on people now in a new way? Is there an abandonment that's gone on of, now we talk about the elites very casually, that's a new experience for me. What do you see happening?
Yeah, I think the caller, you know, what he said about there always obviously being poor white people and folks on the margins is absolutely true, but I also think it's consistent, the fact that there have always been poor people, that there always will be poor people, that there's a question about how the poor folks themselves respond to it and whether, you know, folks on the margins, whether kids on the margins like me can have a better chance at a better life. I think that what we've seen the past 20, 30 years is not just that we've always had poor people and they're still doing bad, but they have actually, you know, things have actually gotten worse. I think that shows up in the statistics, the upward mobility statistics, the inequality statistics, but I also think it shows up in the really deep cynicism that people feel about their own lives. And the point that I make in the book is that absolutely globalization is an important part of this story, but I almost failed out of high school and here I am at Yale Law School. People think that I'm a genius because I came from poverty to Yale Law School, and I don't think that's true. What I think is true is that my mamaw, who I write about in the book, and my papaw really came along and saved me, and they saved me from a lot of the worst impulses in this community. I want to save more kids like that. I want more kids to have an opportunity to live the life that I lead. Are we going to make that happen for every kid? No, but I think we can make it happen for a few more.
How do you do that? If not better economic circumstances, which surely would give a little more ease and room to invest and read and buy a new light bulb for homework, you know, in the absence of that.
Yeah, I think there are two ways to look at it. So one, I think that poor white folks themselves have to think about how they're interacting with the world, whether they see the president as some foreign alien or maybe just a guy they disagree with politically, how they engage with their churches and communities. So I do think there's an element of self-reflection and introspection that has to happen for my people on this side that can make things a little better. I think from a policy perspective, I hope that folks who read the book will realize that the types of problems these communities are facing are unique, and there are things that we might do that would be a little bit different than what we're doing right now that could help people.
Like what? Are you talking government outreach? Are you talking about churches getting more materially engaged?
Yeah.
If nobody's attending, how are they going to get engaged?
Sure. So I talk about this a bit in the book, and I don't think government can do everything, but I do think government can do some things. And so one of the suggestions that I make is that family policy should really recognize the way that Appalachian folks are different from everybody else. So when I first engaged with the social welfare system, it was with a social worker threatening to take me from my grandmother, who was my savior, mm-hmm. and give me to a foster parent. Mm-hmm. I think if the social welfare services recognize that in families like mine, these big interconnected groups can actually save these kids and would be more willing to put kids in what people call kinship care, I think that would really help kids like me.
We can deal with these issues or we can ignore them, but look at our politics right now. We can't get away from them. J.D. Vance
Absolutely.
Writes in Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. J.D., thanks for sitting down with us today.
Thank you, and thanks to the callers, too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.